On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have a full house of experts today. We have Mr. Brian Chee, Mr. Curtis Franklin, and Mr. Brian McHenry here to talk about some great enterprise topics. Not only do we talk about DNS over HTTPS and how a new ISP partnership might actually surprise you and help leapfrog the adoption forward, but we also talk about this period of coronavirus has shown many new trends in the industry, and we're seeing some new ones pop up in InfoSec job training as well. Curtis is going to take us through that and what he's seeing. Plus, the fight for misinformation is definitely real, and the Twilight Riot talks about whether services are doing enough here and if we need some government regulation. Shouldn't miss it. Twilight on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twilight, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 399, recorded June 26th, 2020. DNS over SSL and fighting misinformation. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Red Hat OpenShift. Red Hat OpenShift is the Kubernetes platform that provides a trusted foundation for the on-premises, hybrid, and multi-cloud deployments today's enterprise demand. Go to openshift.com/enterprise now to check out its features. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/enterprise. And by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twilight, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their fields, starting with our very own security and enterprise expert, Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, it's always great to see you, my friend. How are you?
It is great to be here, Lou. It's a fine day to be on Twilight. It's been a busy week in the cybersecurity world. I'm going to be talking a bit about that and have lots of exciting things coming up because, you know, we're only about a month away from Black Hat. And even though that we've got there are rumors that we've got a pandemic going on in the world, Black Hat is continuing and lots of exciting stuff. I'm already talking to some of the presenters and there's going to be a lot of exciting stuff happening there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the coverage for sure. Well, speaking of we have a full house of experts today and we have another security expert. He's the director of global security solutions over at F5 Networks, our very own Mr. Brian McHenry. Welcome back, Bam. Great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good to be back. I have been busy with Shape Security and getting them onboarded. In fact, we just started offering it as part of our Silverline managed service offering. So you can get all your web app firewall, DDoS, and Shape bot protection in one place. So pretty exciting stuff there.
That sounds exciting. Very cool. Very cool. Well, speaking of experts, we have another expert on the show, our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chee. Cheebert, I always ask, how's the packing coming?
Packing's going well. I'm actually working with the campus Department of Public Safety. We're building a mobile security cam system, and we're going to recycle an old basketball backboard support. And, you know, those ones where you fill up the base with sand or water. And right. The idea is to move it around and put it in hot spots. Ought to be a lot of fun. Got to tinker, right?
Yeah, a lot of fun. You guys do a lot of fun stuff. Very cool. Very cool. Well, speaking of interesting weeks, we've had a really interesting one in the enterprise news. Now, DNS over HTTP, it's been debated between browser providers and ISPs for a while. But a new partnership actually might surprise you. that can actually help leapfrog the adoption forward. We'll talk about it. Plus, the period of coronavirus pandemic has shown many new trends in the industry. In fact, we're seeing some new ones pop up in the InfoSec job training as well. Curtis is going to take us through what he is actually seeing. And the fight for misinformation is real. We all know that. And there's some latest news that might get you wondering about all that. But first, it's been a busy week in the enterprise, so let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, credit card skimmers have been around for a while, and some in the wild are basically minor hardware hacks to capture the data when you swipe your card. However, there's an increasing number of attempts to make this easier for cyber criminals to do it online as well, especially during this past quarter with coronavirus pandemic at its peak. Now, the increased online shopping has given rise to cyber attacks dedicated to the covert theft of payment card information used when making online payments. Now, cyber criminals making use of online credit card skimmers continue to improve their attack methods here. Now, the essence of the new attack types are to hide credit card skimmers in order to evade detection. Now, malicious code has been found buried in image file metadata loaded by e-commerce websites. Now, after well-known brands were hit in quick succession, including Ticketmaster, British Airways, the term MageCart was coined for those types of attacks, in which malicious JavaScript is injected into the payment portal pages of vulnerable websites in order to harvest customer details for as long as possible without detection. Now, countless e-commerce domains have been victim here. And in fact, MageCart, of which prolific cyber-criminal gangs known to specialize in card skimming have been split up and named as a separate MageCart group for tracking purposes. However, it seems MageCart group number 9 has gone even further here. Now, card skimmer code was found buried within the EXIF metadata of an image file, which could be then loaded by a compromised online store. Now, the attack is variation that uses fave icons, but with a twist. Now, malicious code was tracked back to a malicious domain called cddn.site that's loaded via favicon file. Now, while the code itself did not appear malicious at first at glance, a field called copyright in the metadata field loaded the card skimmer using an image head tag, specifically via an HTML on error event, which triggers if an error occurs when loading an external resource. When loaded in a compromised website, the JavaScript grabs input from fields used to submit payment information, including names, billing addresses, and card details. Then the obfuscated code within that data is executed and can perform any number of operations. We have learned from SQL injection techniques in the past, helps to sanitize data inputs before using them in code execution. This might also mean site developers need to start applying these techniques, even to image data.
Big attacks are showing shifting cybercrime tactics. The past month has seen a spate of record-breaking and intensely long distributed denial of service or DDoS attacks leveled at hosting providers and enterprises, suggesting a shift in tooling and botnet sourcing among the most advanced professional threat actors. The latest attack was revealed by researchers at Akamai, who reported another high watermark. On June 21st, its team mitigated the largest ever packet per second DDoS attack that they'd ever recorded on their platform, one that was double the volume of the previous packets per second peak. At its height, the attack sought to overwhelm its target, a large European bank, with 809 million packets per second. The attack ramped up very quickly, moving from normal traffic patterns to its peak volume within 2 minutes and lasting just under 10 minutes. Now, why did I mention packet-based so often? Because there's a difference. Where bits per second volumetric attacks try to overload the inbound pipeline, packets per second volumetric attacks work to exhaust internal network resources. Criminals have been turning up the heat with higher and higher volumes of both varieties of attack lately. The announcement of this packet-based DDoS comes just a week after Akamai came forward with news that it had recently rebuffed the largest ever bandwidth attack as well, one that targeted a website of major hosting provider in early June and clocked in at 1.44 terabits per second.
More on record-breaking DDoS attacks later, but for now, let's go into the impending doom of root certificates authorities and the smart devices that depend on them. Security researcher Scott Helm published an article this month on expiring root CA certificates that's been picking up visibility in even the mainstream media. The reason crypto nerd topics are suddenly of interest? These expiring Root CA certificates can have a profound impact on many smart or IoT devices. Everything from refrigerators to TVs could abruptly lose contact with the internet servers they rely on for those smart features. These Root CA certificates enable a client to validate a certificate chain with the issuing certificate authority. Validating the server certificates from your favorite websites were actually issued by a trusted authority. These Root CA certificates are embedded in every browser and other client OS that relies on the public key infrastructure, or PKI, established by the certificate authorities. For browsers and most general purpose and mobile operating systems, these Root CA certificates are updated by regular update mechanisms. However, for many IoT devices, these updates aren't as routine or even automatic, if they happen at all. Some manufacturers like Roku have already been posting proactive warnings to update and have a workaround available using a USB drive. Other manufacturers aren't quite so proactive, and once the Root CA certificate expires, the client loses all ability to make a valid connection to the server, necessitating workarounds that usually involve the old-fashioned sneaker net of plugging in the thumb drives, at least we're not stuck with floppy disks, and assuming the device in question even supports USB, that is. Root CA certificates, unlike server certificates, have very long expiration times, often 20 to 25 years. And it just so happens that many certificate authorities have been around just about that long and are hitting these expiration dates. Many of these Root CA certificates were issued long ago and yet still being installed on devices manufactured within the last 10 years. So it's not a problem confined to older smart devices either. So if you have come to love some of those Wi-Fi enabled features of the smart devices in your home, be sure to check for updates with the manufacturer before you get bitten by an expired certificate.
You know, car keys have always been an interesting issue. Well, Apple is changing that. So Apple is going to add car key functionality to iOS 14, and our friends at BMW are going to be the first in line. So this last Monday, Apple revealed a new feature in iOS 14 that will allow some users to ditch the keys to their car. It's called Car Key. And it's Apple's implementation of the Car Connectivity Consortium's Digital Key Release 2.0 standard, which was finalized in early May. The idea is pretty simple. You pair your phone with your car, assuming your vehicle supports this new standard, and from then on, you can use the device to unlock and start your car. The digital key communicates with your car via near-field communication, aka NFC, and is stored in the same secure enclave that your iPhone uses to store credit cards. That means it's protected by Face ID or Touch ID, and although there's an express mode option that does allow you to skip the authentication. And since it's a digital key, it can also be shared with other iOS users the way you share other items in your iOS wallet. However, you don't need internet access for it to work, so there shouldn't be any worries about being locked out of your car if you take a trip out to the boonies. Although this is the first time Apple has implemented this connected car tech, it's not a new idea. BMW will be the first car maker to support Apple Car Key when the facelifted 5 Series goes on sale in July, but the German OEM has already offered an Android version for some time now via its BMW connected app.
We've discussed many times in the past around governments around the world looking for encryption backdoors to ensure they have access to information when they need it. Now, look at Australia's encryption busting law. It was said that this law could actually have global privacy impact going forward. Now, this is the reason for this law is what's fueling many countries, including the U.S., to look to make their own policies here. That said, this year has been a notable surge in legislative proposals that made it to the writing down stage, and they've revolved around two subjects that both Democrats and Republicans seem to agree on and deserve some attention here. And the first one, which we will talk about later in our bites, is that the Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, which permits companies to moderate content on their platforms without being legally or held legally liable for everything their users post. Now, the second is the Lawful Access to Encrypted Data Act. Now, it creates a legal framework that allows law enforcement officers to obtain court orders to access encrypted digital communications. This recently drawn up bill appears to be a formal codification of what top judicial officials have sought for well over two decades. Now, it will enhance the government's ability to bust through secure encryption, which can make data on a cell phone or a computer almost unreadable to anyone who does not have the password to decrypt it. Now, this bill caught the eye of the U.S. Attorney General as well. Now, here's his quote. Now, passing legislation that allows warrant access to encrypted data will allow law enforcement to further provide for the safety and security of American people. Now, this is a sign of things getting truly serious here. It might be time for you to get in touch with your representative and let them know security and privacy need to be on the rise without those easy unlock back doors.
Microsoft is previewing Windows Defender ATP for Android. Microsoft has released a preview of the Microsoft Defender ATP version for Android mobile devices and rolled out its first production version of the tool for Linux systems. Defender ATP security tool includes phishing protection and scanning of applications and files for malware. It works with Microsoft's Endpoint Manager and Conditional Access products. The Linux version of Microsoft software represents yet another move by the company to extend its tools beyond its Windows-based platforms. According to Rob Lefferts, Corporate Vice President of Microsoft 365 Security, quote, "This release marks an important moment for all Microsoft Defender ATP customers when Microsoft Defender ATP becomes a truly unified solution to secure the full spectrum of desktop and server platforms that are common across enterprise environments, Windows, macOS, and Linux," end quote.
Distributed denial of service or DDoS attacks have been around for decades at this point, yet they remain a serious threat to availability. As bandwidth and compute resources become more readily available to the public, so too have they become available to hackers aimed at taking down sites and services for extended outages. Amplification attacks have made it possible for a single home computer with a 100 megabit connection to generate attacks at a once unfathomable scale of 5 terabits per second. In 2000, a DDoS attack in the hundreds of megabits per second took down Yahoo, E-Trade, and Buy.com. By 2011, attacks on the scale of gigabits per second, accelerating to a whopping 1.7 terabits per second attack recorded in 2018. And Amazon last week, not to be one-upped by our friends from Akamai, as reported by Kurt earlier, reported a 2.3 terabit per second attack that was thwarted by their AWS Shield service. These massive attacks can actually ramp up incredibly quickly as well, in just a few minutes. This gives organizations and the providers very little time to react and respond. One of the more recent innovations DDoSers have hit upon is exploiting misconfigured servers running CLDAP, short for Connectionless Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, a Microsoft derivation of the LDAP standard. The mechanisms use user datagram protocol or UDP packets to query and retrieve data from Microsoft servers. In the past, DDoSers abused servers running other widely used protocols that have been misconfigured. When that's set up correctly, Memcached, a database caching system for speeding up websites and networks, could amplify DDoS attacks by an unthinkable factor of 51,000, an innovation that powered the 2018 record of 1.7 terabits per second. Other than these amplification methods, which are usually only available through sloppy administration of those services, the wide availability of devices, especially poorly secured IoT devices, has made it very easy to harness the power of thousands of machines in a botnet capable of executing massive DDoS attacks. In a report of a recent attack, Akamai says that 96% of the IP addresses had never been seen before and couldn't be filtered by IP reputation systems, indicating the machines were all recently compromised for use in a botnet. The target organizations aren't the only ones affected by these massively scaled attacks either. Providers, internet peering points, DNS servers, and other infrastructure relied on by many can be taken out as collateral damage, causing even wider spread outages. Every enterprise organization should consider DDoS attacks as part of their risk profile and plan for business continuity appropriately.
So I want to share a dark reading article. Basically, the headline says employees are saying they're working from home without security guidance. The sudden rush to work from home has left companies scrambling to secure millions of enterprise logins, while a new study supports that 93% of now remote employees are confident their employers are securing their work. The workers also cite significant shortcomings in the technology and training providing that security. The study by IBM Security and Morning Consultant finds 53% of work-from-home employees are using their personal computers to do their jobs, yet 61% say they haven't been given new technology to secure those machines, and 43% say they haven't received new training on secure remote access computing. Before the pandemic, only 14% of employees report their employers broadly allowing work from home. 41% of the users say their jobs require them to handle personally identifiable information, aka PII. More than half say they are either unsure about any new policies regarding the handling of PII, or they're sure there's no new policy. And while 75% report they now hold at least one meeting weekly via video conferencing, 54% say there are no new security policies to deal with those remote meetings. So one of the things I do want to say is Dan Gear, I'm going to keep saying Dan Gear's keynote from Black Hat a couple of years ago, really and truly says the edge of the network is now in the home. We need to get people to stop using these El Cheapo firewalls that are on really, really ancient versions of the Linux kernel. And if we're going to allow work at home, especially for people handling PII, we ought to at least consider zoning off the worker from the home. Kids are constantly getting viruses, right? And perhaps taking this a little more seriously. So I think we ought to use this pandemic as the golden opportunity to set some real policies.
Indeed, indeed. Well, the right to repair your products, the ones that you buy, has been a topic for consumers and has been discussed for years. Now, as of right now, 17 states have introduced legislation that would give independent repair shops the same access the manufacturers have for genuine parts, tools, and information that help aid the repair process for all consumer electronics. Now, no laws have officially been passed yet in the consumer electronics sector, but the automotive right to repair law was passed in Massachusetts in 2012, which has a similar template to these new bills. Now, this is where the government can step in and possibly do more here. Now, they can ban unrepairable products and help consumers, that's you, to define the most durable products out there. So it actually empowers them and you to make a better purchasing decision. Now, in the EU, political leaders are getting ready to do so. Here's the rub, though. Those leaders don't know what repairable products really are. So if you ask manufacturers, they'll tell you all their products are actually repairable, right? Well, if you ask many technologists and repair people, some devices clearly are more repairable than others, and some are frankly just not repairable at all. So in order to regulate repairability, there needs to be a universally accepted way of measuring how repairable products are done. Now, that's where the European Committee for Electrotechnical Standardization Working Group has been developing for the past 3 years. It was decided early on that the standard was going to be a toolbox. It's a collection of criteria and methods from which you choose depending on the product. Now, first, it laid down the criteria to decide which parts of the product the evaluation should focus on, be it physical parts or code, firmware, software. Then it identified different dimensions of repairability. Some are properties of the product itself, such as the type of fasteners and the tools needed to disassemble the product. Now, some are related to after-sales service, such as support for troubleshooting or the availability of spare parts and information. Now, hence the reason for the European standard being published. Now, this official document with a very unexcited name details general methods for the assessment of the ability to repair, reuse, and upgrade energy-related products. Now, in plain English, it's a standard for measuring how easy it is to repair stuff. It's also a huge milestone for the right for the fight for fair repair. Now, with the European Right to Repair campaign, it's looking to have every single product sold in the EU carry a mandatory repairability label so that people can choose a product that they will be able to fix when it breaks. Now, if you ask me, one of the first disposable electronics that to get such an official EU repairability label should actually be smartphones and then other mobile electronics. Now, picture a moment a few years from now when you drop your phone. You want to be able to pick it up and then have to decide to send it back to the manufacturer to get it fixed, or could you push it toward buying a new one? They want to push you that way? Well, or you could just have a real choice, right? You would like to be in the position to decide for yourself, sign the petitions that are out there right now and help make phones more repairable and make sure that policies change. Take a moment and think about it and make a decision. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Red Hat OpenShift. Now, when I say the name Red Hat, a lot of you are probably thinking Linux, right? Well, that's how the company first made its name, with a trusted Linux distro that served thousands of enterprise customers for well over 8.0 releases. But what Red Hat did for Linux, it's now doing for container orchestration as well with Red Hat OpenShift. Now, Red Hat OpenShift combines the best of Kubernetes with additional features like service mesh, operators, serverless technology, and more. Now, all these help developers and sysadmins do their work with greater ease and automation. Now, that means no downloads or configuration required to get your hands on a cluster. And what's more is the tutorials aren't gated, and you don't need to give your contact information, so no one's going to email you or call you afterwards. For those of you who've heard of OpenShift and want to give it a try, Red Hat has set up a free interactive learning portal with pre-configured OpenShift instances accessible right from your browser. Now is the time to check out container technology and orchestrations. So if you're curious about how Red Hat OpenShift works and want to check out its features, go to openshift.com/enterprise. That's openshift.com/enterprise. And we thank Red Hat OpenShift for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, we've all talked here about on Twite about DNS over HTTPS. And it's one of those, DNS itself is one of those legacy technologies that are always open to attack. Now, one of the fights against this, obviously, has been DNS over HTTPS. However, it's a tough sell to many ISPs out there, even though some web browsers are trying to build the requirements into their applications. In fact, Firefox, being somewhat of a leader here, has developed a program called Trusted Recursive Resolver, TRR program, that's trying to recruit ISPs to join the program and get started. Now, some content provider networks and DNS services like Cloudflare and NetDNS already joined Mozilla's program, but the program requires encrypted DNS providers to meet privacy and transparency criteria and pledge not to block or filter domains by default unless specifically required by law in the jurisdiction in which the resolver operates. Now, adding ISPs to the TRR program paves the way for providing customers with the security of a trusted DNS resolution while also offering the benefits of a resolver provided by their ISP, such as a parental control service and better optimized or localized results. Now, bringing ISPs into the TRR program helps to protect user privacy online without disrupting your user experience. That's important here. Now, that is why it's a surprise to say that Comcast has announced they're going to be joining the program as well. That's right, Comcast. Now, Comcast is partnering with Mozilla to deploy encrypted DNS lookups on the Firefox browser. Now, encrypted DNS lookups on the their version of it, actually, the version, Comcast's version of DNS over HTTPS, will be turned on by default for Firefox users on Comcast's broadband network, but people will be able to switch to other options like Cloudflare and NetDNS. No availability date actually has been announced here. Now, you may be asking, what does this actually mean for Comcast? Why? How are they joining? What does that mean for them joining the program here? Well, joining Mozilla's program means that Comcast agreed that it won't, quote, retain, sell, or transfer to any third party except as may be required by law any personal information, ISP IP addresses, or other user identifiers or user query patterns from the DNS queries sent from the Firefox browser, along with other requirements, of course. Now, Mozilla noted in their announcement that encrypted DNS is the first step towards privacy and not the only necessary step. However, the really interesting part here is the partnership between Comcast and Mozilla is the fact that they've fought many times around plans to deploy DNS over HTTPS in browsers. And Mozilla's work on the technology is largely intended to prevent ISPs from snooping on their users' browser history and browsers. Now, as Mozilla moved ahead with plans to automatically switch Firefox users to encrypted DNS providers such as Cloudflare and others, Comcast actually said it does not track its broadband users and web browser histories and launched a public beta of its own version of DNS over HTTPS. So they were firing back here. Eventually, they began to work together. Now, I guess all working together may actually work out here. Comcast joining Cloudflare and NextDNS and adoption of the Firefox encrypted DNS solution really does help customers out there. We'll have to see what's going on. I want to bring my co-host back in because this is a very interesting partnership here. Bam, I want to start with you. What do you think the signal here is that Comcast is actually joining this program?
I think what it says is it does a lot to debunk the notion that service providers are looking for every opportunity to snoop on what you're doing on the internet. The case was made that, you know, when we talk about net neutrality, that the providers are going to want to limit where you go on the internet based on whether or not maybe it's affiliated, you know, Comcast being a good example, right? Would they want to slow down your access to Netflix so that their own NBC Universal Peacock service would have a higher priority, right? So a lot of concerns about snooping as regards to relates to net neutrality. And it seems like this is a sign that there's an acknowledgement from the service providers that's a losing battle, right? That customers of theirs, of their other services beyond just internet access, have already said, you know, hey, we want access to all the streaming services. We need access to all these things, and to limit that traffic in any meaningful way would be, you know, detrimental to their core business of providing internet access. So I think that's a good sign that you know, they don't see a value in that kind of tracking. Not to mean that those fights are by any means dead or won, but certainly a good sign. I'd be more impressed by this, though, if it was a partnership with Google and Chrome, which also has DNS over HTTPS capable, but I don't believe it's yet by default.
Right. They're actually still in beta in that program. So, but I do tend to agree with you. I do tend to agree that maybe they've just kind of maybe given up slightly and decided that maybe it's the right thing to do. But Curtis, I want to throw this to you because I think it makes sense for companies like Cloudflare and others to kind of adopt this technology for the security sector. But Comcast seems to always do this thing where they might concede to something, but find other ways to make money. Is this just way Comcast saying, hey, we believe in the technology, we're going to move forward with it? Or do you think there's something else going on here?
Well, I think there are some slightly more subtle messages being sent. And one of them is that Comcast is going to make a real statement to consumers, and it doesn't really care what it says to the enterprise, because you mentioned Cloudflare. So let's be honest. You've got DNS over HTTPS. You've got DNS over TLS, which in theory do the same thing, but they do them a little bit differently. And one of the important things to remember is that DNS over TLS is a bit easier for enterprise customers to manage. It goes out over a separate port. DNS over HTTPS does go out over 443 along with all the other HTTPS traffic, whereas the TLS is a separate port. So there are some subtle things here. I think there's a lot of signaling here that Comcast really wants to be a strong voice in favor of the consumer and convince those consumers that they don't need to write to their regulators and insist on, you know, nasty things like net neutrality. As far as real DNS security, I think this does do a lot about protecting consumers from having a third party know what their DNS queries are. So it does go a way towards keeping someone from gathering data on where you're going on the internet. It's not quite as strong in protecting against attacks like cache poisoning and other things. So it's a real mixed bag, and I think this may be one of those cases where there is more flash and sizzle than there is stake in this announcement.
Right. Chipman, I want to throw it to you because I know that Google, obviously, Curtis alluded to it a little bit, is that Google has kind of their own version of this, and they're focusing on DNS over TLS. So, you know, is there a big difference here? Why do you think Comcast chose one versus the next?
I don't know. You know, DNS over TLS is, in my mind, a superior technology. Because from an enterprise standpoint, I totally agree with Kurt. Being able to have that separate port means it's easier to do things like prioritization and things like that. I think my answer is actually going to be kind of along the lines of what a lot of these surveys are saying, and that is, who do you trust? And just listening to the conversation in the chat room, it's like, I don't think a lot of people trust Comcast. There's seems, you know, if I was going to choose who I'm going to trust, Comcast or Google, my personal opinion is I'm going to lean towards Google. Comcast has shown itself to be, shall we say, self-serving, I think is a good opinion. And I'm going to stress that word. It's my opinion. Right. I really don't want to get sued because Comcast also has that tendency. So, yeah, TLS can be controlled. Now, as far as the two technologies go, the encryption engines are in modern CPUs. So it, from a load perspective, TLS and HTTPS are very similar in load on the hardware. But again, having that separate port for TLS means the enterprise has more control.
Right. I do agree. Like, it says something when we say, hey, who do we trust here? We obviously, there's going to be a lot of trust issues when it comes to ISPs in general, not just Comcast, I think, with a lot of things going on out there. But I do want to, the interesting thing here is there have been kind of a feud between both browser technology companies like Chrome and Google and Firefox for a while. Because a lot of these, in fact, I think Google was saying, hey, even in our beta, we're going to start forcing this traffic over that. So, Bam, I want to throw this back to you. What do you think? Does this mean the feud is over? Do we have to not worry about Comcast fighting over this anymore? Now they're going to hopefully move on to the next thing and not have to worry about the Firefox browser wars anymore?
Like I said, I think, you know, Chrome dominance is the thing to watch, right? So I think the last I checked, Chrome is sitting at about 60-70% browser share, market share for browsers. So if Chrome doesn't adopt DNS over HTTPS in a big way, and ergo, you know, that, you know, Google, as we mentioned, has a dog in this fight for DNS over TLS, I think this is more of a, you know, a non-news item for now, in my view, right? This is something, you know, this is progress in the right direction, but I tend to think that DNS over TLS is a better solution as well. In as much as, you know, once we embed DNS into the HTTP protocol and then tunnel it over SSL, you've got to build like all new protocol parsers in your network infrastructure in order to support that and filter it in a meaningful way. We already have DNS protocol parsers. We already have TLS termination points. So DNS over TLS is actually a lot easier to inspect and to stand up services that can handle them, because you already know how to deal with DNS you know, transit and inspection challenges. So I think this is far from over, because, you know, if you're disagreeing with Google, it means, you know, you're not you know, agreeing with Chrome, which is the dominant browser, and what they do is ultimately with Chrome as the default is going to be the thing that rules the day. So this is a small battle, and maybe it signals an early turning of the tide, but I think we still have to wait and see what Google decides to do.
Yeah, let's hope it's a signal of the turnings of the tides. Well, folks, we're going to come back. We're going to have some more bites to come back to. We were going to talk about a little bit of some industry trends that are coming along. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Now think about it. Suddenly you have dozens, hundreds, or even maybe thousands of employees working remotely, each of them getting tons of emails every day, making them vulnerable. Now 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. Multiply that by how many employees? Now times how many emails? One click on the wrong email can cost you money, customers, and even your reputation. Now, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they have observed a recent spike of over 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. Now, get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. What it all includes is a ton of stuff here. All-in-one email security, backup and archiving. It actually has AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and even business email compromise. It also has automated incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks. Now, security awareness training is available to educate your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. Now, we have covered this a couple times here on Twiat, but in the current climate, the bad guys are targeting people using social engineering techniques. Now, they impersonate organizations like the UN World Health Organizations and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to trick users into actually opening malicious emails. Users access the malicious code sites in those emails, and that's it. Their devices are now compromised. They're now the attacker's device. It's time to take back control of your security. Ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure, free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/enterprise. That's barracuda.com/enterprise. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Well, the period of the coronavirus pandemic has shown us many new trends in the industry. In fact, we're seeing some new ones pop up in the InfoSec job training area as well. Curtis?
Well, when things change, the most successful individuals are those who can learn from the new environment. And no one can claim that the year so far hasn't been a new environment for most of us. It's been entirely separate from anything we've seen before. So whether you've been busier than ever or you've recently joined the ranks of the unemployed, cybersecurity pros have been learning new skills to get by, training in the school of hard knocks or in more formal settings. I went out and talked with the CEO of Cybrary and asked some other people the questions. What kinds of security training modules have become more popular or less popular? Are there particular skill sets that people seem more or less interested in developing? What do you see as most essential and what is not essential? Now, some of these are going to have consequences that last for the duration of the pandemic, while others may have consequences that last for years to come. I'm going to talk to my co-host about which those might be in just a little while. So what kinds of things are those whose job it is to train people seeing as trends in what people want to learn? Well, the first thing is that there's a great hunger for hands-on skills, particularly skills that might well be necessary when preparing for a new job, something that's different from the career path you have been on. Ryan Corey, who's CEO and co-founder of Cybrary, talked to me about this, and he says this focus on skills doesn't really surprise him because hiring managers want to see potential employees who can demonstrate skills in a hands-on simulation as part of the hiring process. Now, he has seen a dramatic increase in individuals who want to take practical courses with hands-on labs and exercises, courses that do indeed prepare them for this interview process. Now, the flip side of this is that they have seen a dramatic decrease in learning that is aimed toward certifications. We're a little surprised about this because traditionally, getting a certification is seen as a step towards getting a new job. But Corey says that he is hearing more and more hiring managers say that they place less importance on certifications and more on these demonstrable hands-on skills. Now, interest in certification hasn't gone away completely, but the pendulum has swung to being more 80% skills-based training versus 20% certification. Now, how about those jobs that people are training for? What do they want to do? Well, it seems that everybody wants to be a SOC analyst. The Security Operations Center, or SOC, is clearly where a lot of people see the real action being in coming months and years. Now, when I talked to Corey, he said that the interest in SOC training starts at the junior level and extends to those trying to move from junior to senior levels within the SOC. Now, why would this be? One of the reasons many people that we talk to say that this could be is that the SOC is seen as something that is going to be there regardless of whether it's on premises with a company or in the cloud at a managed security service provider or MSSP. Wherever it's going to be, it's going to exist. And wherever there's a SOC, there's going to be a need for SOC analysts. What about skills that have not been asked for? One of the things that seems to be on the decline right now is penetration testing. Now, we were puzzled about this and asked some people, and the best guess they could come up with is that many companies see pen testing as a nice to have rather than a must have. You know, unless they're part of a very specific compliance regimen that requires pen testing as part of the audit, pen testing is being shoved to the back burner. And when IT professionals see something being shoved to the back burner, they tend to want to be trained in something else. The thing that they do want to be trained in, though, in addition to the SOC analyst, is cloud security. Cloud analysts, cloud systems administrators, cloud security professionals. These are all jobs that people are very interested in. Why? Because their companies are moving to the cloud. Whether it's a company making a full jump to the cloud, saying we're getting rid of our data center, going only to the cloud, or those who are going to a hybrid architecture. Yes, we're keeping our internal data center, but we're adding cloud. Either way, they need cloud professionals and, from this perspective, people who know how to defend the cloud against attackers. So let me look at my co-hosts. Bam, I'm going to come to you first because you are neck deep in cybersecurity. Have you seen or heard about any differences in what people are interested in being trained in or learning if they want to pivot to cybersecurity?
Yeah, absolutely agree that there's a huge uptick in AWS certifications, for example. AWS, Amazon Web Services, has a really robust certification program, which some folks may not know. You know, understanding the architecture of the Amazon Web Services platform, of the different capabilities that are in that platform, how to properly secure it if you bring your applications and other services into AWS is really vital skills. So it's not as simple as just migrating to the cloud, as we all know. But every one of these public cloud providers has nuance to how their architecture works and what are the best practices for, you know, applying security. And so, you know, just as you said, as companies look to migrate completely or partially, even partially to the cloud, they're looking for people who understand the pitfalls of securing there. They don't want to be the next company who had unsecured access to S3 buckets with sensitive data information in it, right? That's, you know, so I think there's an awareness around this, and people are looking for folks that are certified there, as well as, you know, how to get compliant. So, you know, certain compliance type certificates are becoming more important. Myself, I've recently gone back to school for a cybersecurity bachelor's degree, and, you know, you know, there's a heavy emphasis on certifications throughout the bachelor's program. So, you know, they've got to go out and get third-party certificates in order to support the degree program. And so while I think certificates are probably somewhat de-emphasized, they're looking for people with real-world experience, I still think certificates are a great way for someone to break into the industry when you can't get the on-the-job experience. I think, you know, certificates are a great way to kind of kick open a door when, you know, you haven't yet gotten the experience, you know, sort of that chicken and the egg scenario. Can't get the job without the experience and can't get the experience without the job. And I think that's one of the key places that certifications still play, even in today's climate.
Well, I absolutely agree. And what you are saying echoes what I've heard a great deal about. Lou, would like to find out from you, have you heard in all of the people that you've been talking with any interest in learning new things during the pandemic, whether it's involved with wanting to shift jobs or not? Are you hearing people using the pandemic as an opportunity to go out and learn new things?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing definite trend, obviously, in more interest in the security professional side. And you know, we were talking to the back channel here, and I'm actually seeing, lo and behold, more people interested in compliance, because a lot of organizations out there seeing a lot of these startups popping up where they're providing services, whether it's using AI or machine learning to go and provide your organization with better ideas into what you need to be compliant or compliance things. But again, a lot of organizations are looking to professionals for that. So, you know, understanding the markets, understanding government clouds, understanding compliance and what's going on and what kind of services and how they need to be compliant, what they need to do to be compliant is actually a really interesting thing for a lot of people. And again, it's a big business for a lot of organizations because that's a gap in their knowledge base. So I'm definitely seeing people kind of focus and kind of gravitate towards stuff like that. Another thing is obviously information security as well. Is like, for instance, you know, am I storing my data in the cloud? Am I storing it on-prem? How am I storing it? Where am I putting it? Where can it could be performant for me to collect it or access it, but still have it be secure? That kind of thing. So a lot of people are looking and moving into that kind of realm as well. So I definitely think in this pandemic, people are looking towards the trends and what's actually popping up, especially during this time. And going and learning about those things. And to kind of echo what Brian is saying, like I get a lot of people who come in and apply for jobs that might not have the skills but have looked into certifications or additional minor degrees or whatnot in order to gain that experience. And most organizations, they'll test you, obviously. During an interview, they'll walk you through, you know, different skill sets that they want to know about, whether you have them or not, by putting you in situations and asking you things. So these certifications just fortify that you probably do know this information. And I definitely think that they're useful. But like he said, you can sometimes learn these things on the job as well. So I think there's definitely benefit in both sides of the story.
Absolutely. Well, Chibert, I want to come to you next. I know that you have, over the years, mentored an awful lot of young people or people entering the field. Looking at what's out there now, if you were advising someone, what do you think people should be learning during the pandemic?
So this is one of those things where I really and truly agree with Bam's comment that a certificate is a really good way of breaking in. However, I want to take that a little further. And that's actually what my entire curriculum was about. I actually used to use the ISO 7-layer model as my syllabus. And while I didn't want my students to become cable monkeys, apologies to the cable monkeys out there, cable folks. What I did want them to do is I want them to learn what's involved with terminating fiber or terminating Cat 5, you know, outside plant, inside plant. I wanted them to learn about it so they could make more intelligent decisions. And this is my huge, huge, huge gripe with today's management. They are so blinded by certificates that it is really, really, really rare to see a position written for a generalist. And it is my personal opinion that the generalist is the one that sees the big picture, how things work together. I cannot tell you how many people have approached me after I retired saying, you're able to see the bigger picture. Could you consult with us? And I said, no, I can't, because I had to retire technically 5 years early because I couldn't get funding for my generalist position. So as a message out there to management, your generalist is the one that's going to come up with unique solutions. Your generalist is the one that's going to help tie together the collaboration necessary to really meet things, meet the needs of your organization quickly. So I got a little off topic, yeah. But security is about seeing the bigger picture. You know, how things work. My favorite example is someone using a card key for physical access to my facility. But yet, for some reason or another, that same set of credentials was doing a VPN negotiation from Germany. Now, if you don't see the big picture, those are two completely separate and two completely legal actions. But taken in context together, that's a bad, bad thing happening. So it's going to be your generalist that's going to see this. And I personally think security needs more generalists. When I have done hiring in the past, I tend to look for the people that are more generalists than the specialists, because they will see the bigger picture.
Well, I think seeing the bigger picture is something that we all want to do. And speaking of the bigger picture, I'm really interested in what members of the TWIAT audience have been doing about this. If you have used the first 6 months of this year as an opportunity to learn something new, or, you know, frankly, if you've been forced to learn something new, I'd love to know about it. Either send us a quick email message to TWIAT, or hit me up in a direct message to my Twitter account, KG4GWA. Would love to know, and maybe we'll get enough response to do a follow-up to this in weeks to come. Well, speaking of coming up, there's a lot more TWIAT to come. And to start getting us there, Lou, we'll send it back to you.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the fight for identifying misinformation. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ExtraHop. Now, the new IT reality is remote access at massive scale, rapid cloud and multi-cloud adoption, and steady increase in Internet of Things devices, all on top of the rise of cybercrime. Now, it's more important than ever that organizations can see everything going on in their environment, from the cloud to the data center to the customer. But in order to protect and scale your business, you need more than unified visibility. You also need context for detections and intelligent response workflows so teams can collaborate easily and act fast. Now, ExtraHop helps you detect threats and performance issues up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently. Now, ExtraHop helps your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Now, there are some great examples out there. For instance, Wizards of the Coast secures and supports their AWS cloud with ExtraHop. Now, their chief architect and information security officer, Dan McDaniel, said, there's no other company that aligns to supporting the DevOps model, the speed, and the lack of friction than ExtraHop. Ulta Beauty uses ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud as well, and keeping their network security and networking teams closely aligned so engineers have more time to focus on innovation. Now, senior IT engineer John Kreese says, before ExtraHop, we had limited visibility into what was going on in the cloud, but now we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud. Now, if you're ready to take control back and ensure you're securing your remote workforce, get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/enterprise. That's extrahop.com/enterprise. And we thank ExtraHop for their support of This Week Enterprise Tech. So it's definitely true. The fight for identifying misinformation is definitely real. It's definitely real. We all know that in the past, marketing ads have been kind of spreading information for a long time, kind of using neuroscience techniques by storytelling or convincing you that you need something that they want, that they're selling, right? Well, techniques like these have been used for misinformation as well, social engineering techniques. Now, over time, the public has come to expect their news and information to come in more of entertaining forms and maybe even from social networks. Now, facts and figures can sometimes no longer be trusted, and sometimes they end up being spread like wildfires because they end up, you can't tell whether they're real or not real in that case. And in fact, it makes it harder to distinguish between fact and fiction. Well, imagine a social influencer. He comes along and he says, you know what, during this COVID outbreak, there's been an outbreak in this particular area and the government's trying to cover it up. Well, it would take a long time for the public to find out that that was fake. And even so, it also mean that everyone might even be convinced for a long time that that it wasn't fake. Now, there's some services out there that are making use of technology to help assist in something like this. Now, for instance, there's Snopes. We've talked about this before. Snopes, now that when the misinformation obscures the truth and readers don't know what to trust, Snopes.com does fact checking and original investigative reporting, providing evidence-based and contextualized analysis. Now, they try and document all their sources so readers are empowered to independent researchers as well to make up their own minds. Now, it's run by actually a husband and wife team. And that's right, no big office or investigators and researchers, no team of lawyers. It's just a mom-and-pop operation that began as a hobby. Now, the pop has no political party affiliation, and the mom is a non-voting Canadian, but they do make sure that things that they do are very open and very available to everyone to use. Now, factcheck.org, it's called out as a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aims to actually reduce the level of deception and confusion in U.S. politics. They monitor the factual accuracy of what is said by major U.S. political players in the form of either TV ads, debates, speeches, interviews, and news releases. Now, they use best practices for investigative journalism and scholarship and look to help increase public knowledge and understanding. Now, there is a new player in just the last couple of years, started by Steve Ballmer, the USA Facts, and his wife. They actually started this. It's a not-for-profit. It's nonpartisan civic initiative providing a comprehensive and understandable source of government data available. They also standardize assorted data and present it in a plain language with helpful visualizations, assisting in understanding trends in U.S. spending, revenue, population, and demographics and policy outcomes. Now, they partner with academic institutions and experts who help other or are data accurate, be very accurate, and be very unbiased. Now, they also have partners with Penn Wharton Budget Model and the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. And there's other ones in there as well. There's the PolitiFact, as well as Google has now moved to using fact-checking in their contextual fact-checking in their searches, some of their image searches. Reuters has actually started a fact-checking business unit. In fact, we've heard that Facebook is going to start using them as well. Now, we've seen around the world, different countries are battling misinformation in different ways. In fact, we just heard about the recent Trump executive order that actually is attempting to limit the broad legal protections enjoyed by social media companies. And in fact, this particular order takes aim at the 1996 law passed by Congress, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Now, the law protects internet companies from being sued over content that appears on their platforms and allows for content moderation. Now, the order argues, in essence, that if the social media companies restrict certain voices on their platforms, the company should be stripped of their legal immunity, opening the doors to a wave of lawsuits over content seen as deformity. Now, the president's latest confrontation with Twitter was set off after the tech company placed fact-checking warnings on two of his tweets that claimed without evidence that casting ballots by mail allows for voter fraud, but the law itself could actually affect Twitter's major business. Now, in response, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg stated that social media companies should stay out of the business of weighing in on what's true or not. Very interesting here. Now, actually, in a recent interview by Steve Ballmer, former CEO of Microsoft and now the LA Clippers chairman, he had some thoughts on how to handle false data. And he actually thinks, quote, it's easier than people think. Now, negotiation between the industry and the government could be done. It's better done that way than through legislation, because it works by the regulators working with the industry, allowing them to take on the nuances. The industry can explain what's possible. The government can then push the industry to innovate in certain ways. Now, AI will be applied to specific problems. It won't go away overnight, but the innovation is not being applied clear enough right now. He also believes that if you think about it, if you kind of compare it to what's going on in farm right now and coronavirus, farm is kind of being forced to focus on new innovations for COVID. So I think it's kind of a very similar kind of thing. Now, I want to throw this to my co-host, because there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of, you know, ways to go and fact check, but there's also that kind of concept of, should this be regulated? I guess the major question, Curtis, I want to throw this to you. What does freedom of speech really look like on the internet?
Well, I appreciate you giving me the easy one first. That is really quite nice of you. This is tough because it really does weigh on a number of things. I remember when this was first coming out, it was basically interpreted to mean that in order to get the protection that organizations could not do moderation. Basically, if you moderated comments, if you moderated posts, then that meant that you were taking ownership of the content and were responsible for the content. And that shaped things for a long time. That certainly shaped things at a number of publications where I worked and was involved in online forums for years. The trouble is, all of that assumes that there is some level of goodwill, some level of good faith posting, that, you know, essentially if someone is putting up bad information, it's because they believe it to be true. And, you know, they're going to just make an honest statement. What it didn't really take into account was the use of social media as a weapon by those who are against us. And we've seen it used as a weapon by Russia, especially, by China to some extent, by certain other countries, including but not limited to Iran and certain African nations. So what are we to do when it can be weaponized? And that's really the question. The United States, and here let me say, I am very close to being a First Amendment absolutist. I believe that even if you say something that's heinous, the government shouldn't come after you. With that said, Facebook isn't the government. They are a private entity. And just because you have the right to say something doesn't mean that you have the right to a platform. It does not mean that you have the right to a megaphone. It does not mean you have the right to an audience. And so I am inclined to think that as a private company, Facebook should be responsible for what's on its message forums and not let things that it as a company finds objectionable. What I think they should be doing much more clearly, though, is stating where those lines are. We have an awful lot right now of the old standard of, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. I can't define hate speech. I can't define misinformation, but I know it when I see it. Well, in order to have the trust of customers, the trust of the public, they really need to define it. That definition may adjust over time, but they need to have a definition and be open and transparent about how they're applying it. And that is true of Facebook, of Twitter, of all the social media platforms. This is a tough one because, you know, there are organizations and nations that have been doing an informational jujitsu move, using our strength against us. And there has to come a point at which we figure out how to be part of defending ourselves without contorting ourselves to the point that we destroy what we are. It's a tough issue, but I'm glad to see Facebook and Twitter and some of the other platforms beginning to talk about and address the issue rather than pretending that it doesn't exist.
Yeah, Kurt, I think you bring up a good point. Cheebert, I want to throw this to you. I mean, obviously, these companies are going to make their own decisions. Facebook kind of leaning towards not regulating. Twitter kind of leaning towards actually doing some work here to assist in identifying misinformation. What do you think? Should there be more government involved here, more regulation?
I think we need to look at it as do no harm. I personally do not believe government should be involved any more than I think they should be involved in mainstream media, you know, a large press, you know, say like the Washington Post. However, if a outlet, whether it's Facebook or the Washington Post, posts something on there that could potentially be slanderous or incorrect or, you know, what have you, you know, whatever rules you want to apply, they should be held responsible for whatever they publish. I personally am very, very disappointed at the lack of what used to be good journalism. Kurt and I both worked at InfoWorld. One of the things that happened for editors is we had to read other people's work. We had to check other people's work. There were cases where someone was out and out wrong and other editors caught it. That is what's missing. You know, the electronic media, no matter what, it's too easy to press enter. There aren't people checking anymore. And that's one of the reasons why I tell people, I'm a journalist. I'm not a blogger. I follow the old school of how journalism works. Be responsible for what you write. I think that's a lot better than government regulation.
Indeed. Well, one more question before we close up here. Bam, I want to throw this to you because, you know, obviously I think both Cheebert and Curtis bring up a good point here. I guess the question to you is, should I be able to speak freely without speaking accurately without being regulated if I don't speak accurately?
Well, you know, I always learned that you can say whatever you want, but be prepared for the consequences. And so without regulation, there's laws on the books, you know, that you can sue someone, you can, you know, libel or slander, defamation of character, what have you. Sort of like screaming fire in a crowded theater, right? There are types of speech that have consequences. So yeah, you shouldn't be able to say whatever you want. And certainly we have laws that try to limit free speech to the extent that if you say something that's potentially damaging, it, you know, truth being the ultimate defense from any sort of defamation lawsuit. Now, I think the problem is that lawyers are expensive. I think proving defamation is really hard. And I think that's where this sort of falls apart. And, you know, when you listen to Brian and Curtis talk about journalism, I'm not sure that, the most of the world is making that fine distinction anymore of sort of the honorable nature of the profession. And that's not to say that I don't. My older son is actually a budding journalist himself, and I do admire the profession. So to actually come back around and answer the question, all that being said, should I be able to say whatever I want if it's not accurate? I think we need better laws on the books. I think we need consequences, and I don't know if that's regulation. I wish that regulation wasn't necessary. I wish common sense and decency would rule the day, and we would could be held. You know, we would feel accountable to the words we say or print or tweet. So I would love for us to be in a world where honorability and truth matters above all. But I think now with so many people having a platform and a voice easily accessible to them via a blog or a popular Twitter account or even just replying to a popular Twitter account with your own version of the facts. I think we need more accountability, and maybe that does have to come via, unfortunately, a little bit more regulation, because right now the laws we have are a little too lax and a little bit too reliant on being rich enough to afford a lawyer who can prosecute defamation lawsuits effectively. And certainly, who's going to prosecute a lawsuit when it's just simple, you know, falsehoods not about a specific person or entity, but a falsehood about, you know, whether or not COVID-19 spreads a certain way, right? You know, we're dealing with a lot of, you know, false facts being spread about all kinds of really important things that don't necessarily defame a certain person or entity. And at that point, you know, you're starting to veer into speech that's a lot like shouting fire in a crowded theater.
And you guys are very wise. I'm glad to have co-hosts that are as wiser than I am. So thank you guys for being here. Great topic. Like I think Curtis was saying in the back channel, this is definitely a great topic. We'll have to come up and bring it up again because there's a lot more to discuss here. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your device to Twyatt. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my wise co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chiebert. What's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you?
Packing. More packing. I am ADV, NETLAB on Twitter, Advanced Net Lab. I'm also Chiebert, spelled Cheebert, at twit.tv. But why don't you use Twyatt at twit.tv, and that comment will hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear your ideas. Well, I got to admit, I'm not real wild about getting flayed alive or flamed. But, you know, everybody is entitled to their opinion. And you know what? We try to answer them professionally. We try to make sure that your concerns are addressed. And we try to make this as open a forum as possible. So, love to hear from you. Love to hear your ideas for shows. Why don't we hand it back to Lou?
Thank you, Chiebert. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior editor over at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all of your great work?
Well, I've got some conversations coming up with people who are going to be presenting at Black Hat. That's going to be exciting because there are some great topics, some things that I'm certainly interested in learning about. I've got some writing coming up, like the piece that we talked about during my bite today, the things that people learn and aren't learning during a pandemic. I've got some more pieces coming up like that in the coming weeks. Look for me at Dark Reading, or especially at the edge of Dark Reading. And please send me your thoughts. Follow me, KG4GWA on Twitter, Kurt_Franklin on Instagram, or shoot me a message via email. It's I'm always eager to hear from the members of the Twyatt Riot. Thanks, Lou.
Thank you, Curtis. We also have to thank our other expert, Mr. Brian McHenry. Brian, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you?
Well, you can find me at BA McHenry on Twitter. So BAM is not just a nickname. It's actually my initials. So at BA McHenry on Twitter. And I'll be sharing everything that's going on with F5 F5 stands behind the Black Lives Matter movement. I wanted to share that. And we are also celebrating Pride Month. And, you know, we stand with diversity inclusion at F5. And if you're looking for a place to come work and feel supported and feel like, hey, everybody's got my back here, F5 is a great place to work. And, you know, check out F5.com/careers and see if there's a place that you fit right in, and tweet me, DM me, and I'll see if I can put in a good word for you with the hiring manager. So we're still hiring in this, COVID-19 world. And, you know, we're always looking for talented people. So find me where you find me and check out F5.com.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you guys for being here. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to catch up on your enterprise news. Now, go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twite. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Get your audio version, your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your podcast applications or available in all of them. So check it out and definitely subscribe. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So go ahead and subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends with the gift of Twite. You know what? They're going to want to know about enterprise and IT news too. And what better way than help them subscribe to Twite as well. Now, if you're already subscribed and you're available these days on Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do the show live, live.twit.tv. You can check out how the show is run, check out how the pizza's made, all the behind the scenes, all that fun stuff, plus all the banter that we do with the guests and the co-hosts and all that. So come and check us out live. Plus, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the great chat room live as well. We have an amazing set of characters in there today. A lot of people in there today. Really, really impressed with the people that are in there. We had some great topics and questions from there. So jump in there. It's irc.twit.tv. We love the chat room. We get some great questions and discussions, so definitely join them as well. Now, if you're going to watch, you can't watch the show live, actually, that's okay. You can still be part of the discussion and as well as our amazing community. Come join the 24/7 discussion at twit.community. That's a great website out there where all the hosts and the sometimes the guests go out there. We have a lot of great Twit fans and actually technologists out there. They have some great discussions on content and technology. So definitely check that out. It's 24/7 discussion at twit.community. Come join the community. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Plus, I have great conversations with people like you as well. Plus, you can see what I do my normal work week at Microsoft. And if you want to check out what I do at Microsoft, go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There you can check out all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience to make it more productive for you. I want to also thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us in This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do this show without them. So thank you to them both. Also, I want to thank all the engineers at Twit. And of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. He is not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does the show bookings. He does all of the playings for the show. We really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Brian, for all your support. But of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. He's the man behind the camera. He's the switcher. He's the engineer over there. Jeff, thank you so much for your support. How is everything going over there in Twit? And are we starting to see some more people come back?
Still very quiet over here. I'm the only one here today. And, just trying to make it work. But everybody's working really hard from their home office. And when they have to come in, they do. And I'm really proud of everybody here because they've really, really made it happen.
They do. Well, thanks so much, Jeff, for being there. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca. Just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and a rotating crew of Android journalists, developers, and enthusiasts, where we talk about the latest news, hardware, and apps for the Android faithful. You can subscribe by going to twit.tv/AAA or find the show in your podcatcher of choice. That's All About Android.